Welcome back to the Reel. You are listening to Morgan Rousey, the host, and today my special guest is Jera White from Sydney, Australia. And I think, Jera, you're my most popular guest because this is your fifth appearance. I didn't do the counting, but that's my impression. And Jera is the grandson of the Apollo moon hoax theories, so he's heir to the ideas pioneered by Bill Kaysing and Ralph René. And Jera is his, I guess his central website would be moonfaker.com. And he's got a channel on YouTube and has done hundreds of short and long videos exposing the Apollo moon hoax. And welcome back, Jera White.
It's a pleasure to be back again.
It is wonderful to have you on the Reynolds Reveal. Now, I know the main order of business today is going to be a review of the Challenger disaster movie. More to come on that shortly. But I did want to ask a question of you, and give me a minute to set this up, because I was looking at some of these videos of Richard Feynman, the famous physicist who passed away in 1988, and we will get to him in the movie review. But in the course of that, I ran across Richard Dawkins, who is the famous evolutionary biologist, defender of Darwin, a student of animal behavior, and really a popular science author. And in this video, I watched episode one of his video called, quote, "The Enemies of Reason," unquote. And I enjoy a lot of his tweaks at psychics and organized religion and the like. But by the by, he says, and I quote, "Paranoid conspiracies circulate unchallenged. Sometimes they're relatively harmless, like the rumor that NASA faked the moon landings, which is a joke because the evidence for going to the moon is so strong," unquote. So here's a man who keeps on preaching that we've got to value evidence, reasoning, and logic over superstition. And how do you respond to Richard Dawkins, Jera?
That was the first quote I've ever heard of him. I haven't paid that much attention to his research. But yeah, that I thought that was quite interesting. It's important that the moon hoax be recognized that it has valid evidence.
Valid evidence. Amen. Yeah, it's funny to have him dismiss something out of hand where he hasn't looked at the evidence. He couldn't have if he were amazing. He would realize that it was fake, and you're a central figure in proving this up.
Yeah, I've produced something like 90 plus moon fakers. A lot of them I had to chop up to fit onto YouTube to fit with the time constraints at the time. Now I can upload videos more than 15 minutes, and so I'll upload them in my entirety. But if you want to go by the total number of moon fakers, it's something over 90 videos.
It's great. It's a great resource. You are to be honored in history, if not in life, currently. Okay, well, let's go to the you're going to review this movie that the Discover and Science channels made for TV. It was broadcast initially on November 16, 2013, an original movie starring William Hurt and an actor I've always loved, Brian Dennehy. He seems to be playing the villains all the time in his years. And the movie is called The Challenger Disaster, and Jera White knows a great, great deal about the truth of the Challenger disaster, so we're going to have an expert make a movie review. So you just kick it off there, Jera.
Certainly. Now, first, right off the bat, the movie is based in parts on Richard Feynman's book, which was titled What Do You Care What Other People Think? And it was also based on Truth, Lies, and O-Rings, which was written by Alan MacDonald, It was one of the engineers at Thiokol who protested against launching. Now, overall, I think the movie does a good job of demonstrating how NASA tried to cover up a lot of things about cold weather and the like. But at the same time, I have to say that the movie is very, very streamlined. It's the only really word I can describe for this this movie, because it's taken bits and pieces from the books, historical events, and sort of jumbled them around a bit. You stretch them out a bit, moved them here, moved it there. Some for drama purposes. Some were combined probably for the timing constraints. And as a result, a lot of key features or key, elements or characters, historical characters were either combined or ignored or moved or whatever. And so I was rereading, McDonald's book. I also recently picked up a ebook of Feynman's book. I was reading him and making some notes, and I've managed to track down all the individual source materials that were used for all the scenes in these films. I've written some notes here. What I would like to do is I would like to paraphrase what was said, what was done in those scenes, and then explain what liberties were taken. Okay, so early on in the film, right, they show the Rogers Commission. That's the presidential commission which Feynman was a part of. They met in Washington, D.C. on February 5. Okay, in the film, right after Feynman meets the commission.
And by the way, Jera, listeners should know that's 1986, so that's only a couple of weeks after the disaster, right?
That's correct, yes. The Challenger disaster was on January 28, ironically, just a day after the anniversary of the Apollo 1 fire. And so, the disaster was on January 28, and the first meeting with the Rogers Commission was on February 5. Anyways, in the film in which it shows them meeting up in Washington, D.C., having a discussion in the office, okay, Chairman Rogers tells them that they'll, quote, reconvene in 5 days. Not wanting to wait, Feynman repeatedly goes down to Marshall Space Flight Center to investigate on his own free will. And during these visits, he learns that the main engine turbine blades would fracture due to vibrations, and he receives a cryptic ivory soap message from one of the engineers. Now, regarding the liberties taken, right? Firstly, the 5 day wait was actually intended to be after the first two hearings in Washington D.C. They had hearing on Thursday, February 6th, and another on February 7th. Afterward, they planned on flying down to Florida 5 days later for hearings at the Kennedy Space Center. Now, while it's true that Feynman didn't want to sit around waiting for 5 days, he did not make repeated trips to the Marshall Space Flight Center, at least not that early in the investigation. What he did do was speak to NASA Administrator Graham, who was a former student of his, and Graham arranged for Feynman to meet some Johnson Space Flight Center officials at NASA headquarters, which was just across the street from Feynman's motel. Chairman Rogers, when he found out about that, he was very, very angry, and he came down on Feynman like a ton of bricks. There was a long back-and-forth discussion, and after some discussion, he reluctantly agreed to let Feynman talk to these people. Additionally, on the day before the first meeting with the Rogers Commission on February 5, Feynman contacted another former student of his, a fellow by the name of Albert Hibbs, who worked at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, and he asked Hibbs to arrange a meeting with some people at... Hello? Hello?
Yeah, hello.
Yeah, I thought I got disconnected there for a second, sorry. Yeah, he asked Hibbs to arrange a meeting with some Jet Propulsion Laboratory people who knew something about the shuttle so they could brief him. Hibbs did just that, and it was during this visit to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory when Feynman learned about the shuttle main engine's engine turbine blades that would crack under pressure. He also learned that during launch, the engineers would have their fingers crossed, hoping that the engines didn't fail, because the vibrations were so violent. Now, Feynman, he eventually did visit the Marshall Space Flight Center in March of 1986, which was a month after the February meeting. He went there with General Katina, and it was at this time when Feynman met with the NASA Safety Range Officer, a fellow by the name of Julian. Now, I just have to stop for a second. The NASA Safety Range Officer is the guy who's instructed to press the self-destruct button on the SRBs in the event that the shuttle would be flying out of control and was going to come crashing into the city. So it was his job to activate the self-destruct button. The rationale was better to kill 7 astronauts than let 7,000 or so 100 people die. You know, and so yeah, that's what the job of the safety range officer was. Anyways, this guy, he told Feynman that NASA had told him that the chances of a shuttle failure was 1 in 100,000. And Feynman, he replied, That means you could fly a shuttle every day for an average of 300 years between accidents. One day, one flight for 300 years. That is absolutely crazy. That line is actually quoted in the film, although it's been moved to one of the hearings. Anyways, Julian, he agreed, and he added that he thought the actual probability of failure was more likely 1 in 100,000. One in 1,000. Okay, and it was also during the same visit, as a bit of a social experiment, Hyman, he asked three of the engineers down there, and also their manager, a fellow by the name of Judson Lovingood, he asked them to write down on a piece of paper what they thought was the actual, was the probability of failure, and then give that note to him. Okay, this is where they're getting that cryptic soap, ivory soap thing, right? Our best quote to Fireman, he said, one guy wrote 99.4% pure, copying the ivory soap slogan. Yeah, in the movie, right, they changed it a bit, that he received this, someone left him this cryptic message that says, we think ivory soap, and took him a while to figure out that they were talking about the failure, but in actuality, it wasn't a cryptic message, it was someone, he asked them to tell them, to write down a piece of paper what you thought was the probability of a failure. And one fellow, I don't know, being cheeky, wrote down, I estimate, 99.4% pure is the probability of failure. The pure meaning, obviously, the success of the shuttle. So the remaining 0.5%-ish would
be. Yeah, 0.6%. Wow. Well, less than a 1 in 100, it would be failure. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, the second engineer wrote 1 in 200. The third wrote 1 in 300. Whereas Lovingood, the manager, he claimed that the probability was 1 in 100,000. Now, getting back to the early February, where they had that 5-day waiting thing, ultimately they ended up not waiting around for 5 days, because over that weekend, a NASA finance analyst by the name of Richard Cook, he released a smoking gun memo to the press, which he had written, sent this memo to a NASA guy by the name of Mann. He was just pointing out that they need to allocate funds to solve the seals problem. Otherwise, there's going to be a catastrophic failure. He submitted that memo to his NASA managers in July of 1985, which was about a week before Roger Beaujolais, the fire coal guy, sent a memo to his manager saying the exact same thing. Anyways, as a result of this memo by Cook appearing in the New York Times, Chairman Rogers, he arranged to have an emergency closed hearing on February 10, and then a public hearing on February 11th, both in Washington. Now these two hearings are actually shown in the reenacted, I should say, in the movie, albeit with some liberties taken with the dates. I'll get back onto that in a moment. But now the former of these two hearings is the one in which Alan MacDonald, one of the fire coal people who was trying to stop the launch, he actually interrupted NASA manager Larry Malloy. Malloy, during that closed hearing, he was saying that, we received a phone call from fire coal, and they recommended launching. All the NASA people at this stage, none of the people at fire coal had been testifying yet, and all the NASA people, they all said, we never got a no launch recommendation. The only recommendation we got from fire coal was to launch. And in fact, they even started citing this written approval to launch from Joe Kilminster, of course, which they only got after they pressured fire coal to change their minds. Anyways, during the February 10 hearing, it was during this time when Alan MacDonald actually raised his hand, interrupting Malloy's testimony, and spoke up that their original recommendation was not to launch.
Alan MacDonald, Jira, as an aside, Alan MacDonald and Beaujolais, his name is Roger also, right? Roger Beaujolais. They're heroes. And another question I had was, is Brian Dennehy, he plays the head of the commission, Commissioner Rogers, doesn't he?
I didn't have a look at the names of the cast members. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, he's a very big, kind of looks like a football player with white hair, and he's a very aggressive. I always loved him. He's a great actor, I think. Okay.
If you're talking about the fellow who played Chairman Rogers, I have to say he looks kind of like a gorilla in the movie.
Yeah, that's Brian Dennehy. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, so anyways, yes. Yeah, so the testimony when that on February 10, when McDonald interrupted Mulley, that was on February 10, the closed hearing. Now, the February 11 hearing is the one in which Fireman did his O-ring trick. Now, I'll get to that in it shortly. Now, there's another scene in the film in which Fireman and another member of the commission, a fellow by the name of General Katina, they're seen flying together on a private jet, and Katina warns Fireman to, quote, watch your ass, because he was the only independent member of the commission. Now, I don't know if Fireman was ever told this, but I do know that McDonald was told something similar. After McDonald writes in his book that after he testified, there was a public testimony hearing on February 25. He quoting him, he says, I had received a telephone call and a note in the mail from Willie Bunn, the Director of Reliability and Quality Assurance Office at NASA Marshall, supporting my actions and testimony and warning me that Marshall management was plotting against me and that I should watch my backside, unquote. Now, there's also a scene in which it's implied that Fireman was invited over to the Pentagon by Katina so they could discuss NASA's relationship with the Air Force, and it was at this meeting that he encouraged Fireman to cut through the bullshit with science, thus prompting him to do the O-ring experiment. That's another liberty taken with the timing of these events, because the O-ring experiment that was televised, that was during the February 11 hearing, and Fireman's trip down to the Pentagon was on February 12th. I suspect that they probably just, you know, blew artistic license. Well, this trip to the Pentagon, that's pretty photogenic, pretty dramatic, but it happened afterwards. We'll just move it, you know, beforehand, you know, take some liberties here and there.
Right.
And similarly, there's also a scene in which the NASA administrator, he shows up to the commission giving them photos of the leaking SRB, and then later that night, Katina shows Fireman his Opel GT, his car, and talks about the carburetor not working in the cold because of the seals that would stiffen, you know. Anyways, again, these two events are switched around. Katina showed Fireman his car on February 9, and it was the next day on February 10 when they received the photos of the leaking plume coming out of the SRBs. Again, the O-ring experiment was on February 11. Now, just going to show my notes here. The movie, now getting back to the February 11.
Jura, here's a question for you. I recall the acronym SRM, which is a solid rocket motor, and you're using SRV, was it?
SRB.
SRB.
SRB, solid rocket booster.
SRB, that's it.
Yeah, they're both terms are correct. I'm sorry if I use them a bit loosely, but a lot of the people who have talked about this in the commission and in their books and everything else, they generally loosely use the two terms. So both terms are correct. Sort of like
okay, it's also kind of inside baseball where the experts all know what these acronyms are, but the outsiders need to get up to speed. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, if you get confused, just feel free to stop me and just ask for clarification. I tend to use these terms myself so frequently that I often forget how alien they may seem to the casual listener.
Thank you.
Anyway.
Okay, sorry for the now we're at the open hearing on February 11th, right?
Yeah, before we get to that, I'd just like to talk about the February 10 closed hearing for a second. The movie implies that that McDonald was, before we get started, there's actually two groups of people who are actually investigating the disaster. One was NASA's official analysis team, which was being held at Marshall Space Flight Center. And then, of course, we have the Presidential Commission run by Chairman Rogers. Now, McDonald and Beaujolais, both of them were on the NASA team investigating the disaster. Of course, the NASA people, they were doing their utmost best to shift the blame away from cold weather. Now, anyways, the movie implies that McDonald was removed from the SRM failure analysis team for speaking up during Molloy's testimony at the February 10 closed hearing. Well, that's actually a liberty taken, you see, because McDonald, along with Beaujolais, they were actually removed from the SRM failure analysis team after they testified during a public hearing on February 25, not the closed hearing on February 10. These were two different testimonies. It was the public hearing in which they were removed from the team as a result of being honest. And the film also seems to imply that there was a 4 days between the February 10 hearing and Fireman's O-ring in the ice water experiment. But again, the O-ring in the ice water experiment, that was on February 11, which was the day after this closed hearing in which Molloy was interrupted by McDonald. Now, they all in the movie, it also seems to be implied that Fireman's, what he did with the O-ring, you see, what he did, he actually had a C-clamp, got a little piece of O-ring, clamped it down, clamped it onto the C-clamp and stuck it in his glass of ice water. And when he took it out and released it, it didn't bounce back to its original dimensions. It stuck in this clamped position. It's because the cold water had made the O-ring very rigid. Anyways, in the movie, it's implied that this little experiment happened during Malloy's testimony on public testimony on February 12th, right? But in actuality, right, it happened just before Richard Cook's testimony. Now, during Malloy's actual, Malloy had his testimony, right? Then there was a recess. Then there was Cook's testimony, and just before that testimony, Fireman did his experiment. Now, during Malloy's testimony, Fireman kept asking little trick questions to try to basically suck it. If you listen to the questions without any context of knowing what happened, right, you'd have to wonder yourself, why is he asking such stupid questions? In fact, if you look at the video, you can actually see that expression on Chairman Rogers' face. He actually looks as if to say, why are you wasting our time? Because the questions he was asking Malloy was this O-ring, it needs to expand. We have to use rubber. We could not use something like lead. No, it has to have this, has this resiliency. It's, seemed to be pretty obvious questions. But what he was doing, you see, he was basically getting Malloy to basically give him a confirmation, like straight from the horse's mouth, just before he pulls the O-ring stunt on him. Of course, yes. At this stage. Go ahead.
I was going to observe that, Feynman has been declared by some as one of the 10 greatest physicists of all time. And he was a very charming guy. I admire his intellect immensely, who was always looking at to find the simplicity of nature. And he's not a man to be messed with if you want to go up against him one-on-one intellectually.
I guess you could say that. Now, as I was saying, right, when he was asking these questions, right, he actually expected to have the ice water right at the beginning of the testimony because they had glasses of ice water and jugs during the closed hearing the previous day, right? But this time there wasn't any water, so he was asking the secretary for some ice water. And while he was waiting for the ice water to come, and so eventually, getting tired of waiting, he started asking his trick questions to Malloy. The ice water came, and then there was the recess. And just before after the recess, there was going to be Richard Cook's testimony, and Rogers, not knowing anything that Fireman was up to, he said, "Oh, before we get started, I believe our Commissioner Fireman has something he wants to say." And he's like, "Yeah, this is a comment for Malloy. I took this stuff that I got out your seal and I put it in some ice water, and I discovered that when you put some pressure on it for a while and then undo it, it doesn't stretch back. It maintains the same dimensions. In other words, for a few seconds at least, and more seconds than that, there's no resiliency in this particular material when it's at a temperature of, say, 32 degrees Fahrenheit. I believe it has some significance on our problem." Now, Malloy, he was completely stunned by that. And but before Malloy could comment, Chairman Rogers, he actually intervened. Right? I should point out, first of all, in the movie, Chairman Rogers, he's depicted as smiling at this experiment, like he's very proud, like, good move. Nothing could be further from the truth. As soon as Fireman had finished talking, after he took the O-ring out of his drink, Chairman Rogers, he prevented Malloy from commenting, attempting to postpone comments on cold weather until the February 14 hearing in Kennedy Space Center. His quote was, "That is a matter we will consider, of course, at great length in a session that we'll be holding on weather. It is an important point which I am sure that Mr. Malloy acknowledges and will comment on in a future session." Then they went on to proceed with Cook's testimony. Now, in fact, I should point out as well that Rogers, he was so taken off guard by Fireman's experiment that when they began Cook's testimony, he actually referred to him as Mr. Smith, not Mr. Cook. That's how taken off guard he was. But anyways, later that afternoon, when Malloy was brought back for more questioning, this is still on February 11th, right, Fireman, he continued his line of questioning about the frozen O-rings, and even after Malloy had seen that experiment, he had the gall to claim that they had data suggesting that the O-rings would work at minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit. Not 30 degrees Fahrenheit, but minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit. which is absolutely not true. Now, just breaking away from the movie review for just a moment, I have to point out there's a I've talked about this fellow before in past interviews, Mark Gray, the head of Spacecraft Films, which is a company that sells NASA stock footage and the like on DVDs. They sell just being the ultimate space DVDs you can get, the complete historical record, blah blah blah, all that crap. Well, I have to point out that even though Mark Gray, he included both of Molloy's testimonies on his Challenger DVD, and even though he included Cook's testimony on that DVD, he deliberately excluded the first few minutes of that testimony in which showed Feynman doing his O-ring experiment. Think about that for a moment. This is by far considered one of the most significant moments in the entire testimony, in the entire investigation of Challenger. Right. And here is this so-called ultimate Challenger DVD, and the experiment has been excluded from there. He excluded a few other complete testimonies, like Basin's testimony wasn't there. William Lucas's testimony wasn't there. They excluded all this stuff. I have to say, okay, I've said this before and I'll say again, I have no qualms saying this because I know it's 100% accurate. Okay. Mark Gray is one, a liar, two, a con artist, three, a liar. Did I say liar already? Or a perjurer, because he filed false DMCAs to get my videos pulled when I called him out on his bullshit of the Apollo 10 DVDs, and five, he's an asshole.
You know, Martin Luther, and there's a quote from Martin Luther in the 16th century, and I can't reproduce it exactly, but it says in effect that lies are the prelude to murder. The liars and murderers go together. It's a pretty dramatic and I think insightful statement. So lying on this level is a mortal sin.
I'm pretty glad you actually brought up that quote, because this is a perfect segue into my next comments on the film that I'll be reviewing. Okay, and the movie implies that after McDonald interrupted Molloy's testimony on February 10, the movie implies that he became impossible to reach, and that, you know, there are scenes with Feynman trying to reach McDonald on the telephone, not without any success. And later in the film, McDonald is seen at home watching Molloy's February 11 testimony with his family. Now, I don't know if Feynman had any trouble reaching McDonald, but after the closed hearing on February 10, McDonald and all the other Firecall officials, they were all called over to another presidential commission on February 11th at Kennedy Space Center. And before that hearing at Kennedy Space Center, this was a closed hearing. Okay, before that hearing, McDonald, he was so concerned about his company's jet having a crash, you know, on his way to the hearings, he actually made copies of all his notes, put them in a sealed envelope, gave them to his colleague, a fellow by the name of Ivan Adams, and instructed him to give the notes to the commission if anything happened to him. Right? And again, during the testimony, you see McDonald, he was the first one to speak up about there being any no launch recommendation. Right? And after the February 14 closed hearing, McDonald returned home the next day to find the phones ringing off the hook with the press wanting interviews, none of which he accepted. I have a couple examples, but I'll get to those later. I would just like to continue about what happened next first. Later on, McDonald, Mason, Beaujolais, Thompson, Lund, Kilminster, and Russell, they're all called back to Washington, D.C., testified before the Rogers Commission on February 25. This was a public hearing. Okay, all the engineers, they all told the truth about how they constantly persisted against the launching, right, while all the managers, they denied that they were pressured from NASA. They denied that they received any pressure from NASA to change their minds. And in fact, Mason, as I said before, Mason's testimony was not included on the Spacecraft Films DVD. Mason, he went so far as to claim that McDonald, not NASA, was the one who pressured him. See, at the time of the teleconference, McDonald was actually calling in from Kennedy Space Center. You see, some people were calling in from the Firecall facility. Some were calling in from the Kennedy Space Center. And others were calling in from Marshall. You see, the reason some were calling in from Kennedy Space Center is because some of the guys from Marshall and Feynman, they had been scheduled to make appearances at the Kennedy Space Center and, you know, oversee the launch preparations and the like. So they were calling in from Kennedy Space Center. It was McDonald's turn to actually appear at Kennedy Space Center and check everything out. And so that's why he was calling in from Kennedy Space Center. Anyways, they, because he was not at the Utah plant at the time, not at the fire call station, right? Mason actually tried to use McDonald as a fall guy, claiming that it was he who pressured him to change his mind.
And what's your, does the movie depict this, or are you just talking about what really happened?
Well, I'm talking about what really happened because, you see, as I said, certain, this stuff wasn't included in the, because of the streamlining of the movie, a lot of stuff, important stuff didn't get included. Others were just, mixed and matched here and there. And you see, and so it's important that I feel the viewers recognize what liberties were taken with the source material.
Jared, let me ask you a big question to that effect. Now, we all know that the movies compress events, as you point out, and alter sequences. And but the, really, the question for our listeners would be, do you think there was any deliberate deception that the movie makers changed anything? Was that the motive? Do you detect anything like that, or is it just ordinary Hollywood, the problem of making a dramatic and hunt for the mystery, solve the mystery, that whole thing to hook observers and entertain them? So do you think it was all any innocent adjustments, or is there something black going on here?
Well, I don't know if there's anything sinister, but I don't agree to some of the liberties taken. But it's funny you should actually mention that, because just the other day I was actually reading an article that had been published by Richard Cook. He was the NASA financial guy who was arguing that sent a memo that they shouldn't, that they need to fix the booster problem. And later submitted that memo to the press. Anyways, he actually wrote a review about that in which he felt that the movie was covering up the fact that the Reagan White House Commission had been partly responsible for the disaster, because he believed that President Reagan was going to be speaking to McAuliffe when she was in space.
You're listening to The Reynolds Reveal. My wonderful guest, Jared White, who is an expert on the Challenger disaster. Come on back after the break. Welcome back to The Reynolds Reveal. I am your host, Morgan Reynolds, and today's guest is Jared White. If you would like to speak with Jared White, the number to call here at the Guerrilla Media Network is 218-862-9829. And Jared today is dissecting the Challenger disaster, the made-for-TV movie that came out on November 16th. And Jared knows so much about this, he's matching up reality with what the filmmakers did. And before the break, he mentioned the Reagan White House, and President Reagan was going to speak with school teacher astronaut Krista McAuliffe as a PR event. And I wonder if that doesn't get at least in part to the motive of why NASA was so insistent on launching in such cold weather on January 28. I mean, I can see bureaucratic interest in not diverting from schedule, even though you're putting seven lives at extreme risk. Is that part of what was going on, Jared?
Well, what, just recalling back to what I read of Richard Cook's article, he pointed out that the film, if I recall correctly, back to his, I've only read his article once. He recalls the film implies that Feynman, he found out that the Reagan White House wanted to talk to McAuliffe during his president. What's the word I'm looking? What do they call it? The State of the Union address. After the Challenger disaster, that was excised out. He argued that Feynman didn't uncover this, and in fact, the commission actually went out of their way to not mention that in the report or anything like that. Basically, shield the White House from any blame. And it was the theory of Beaujolais and also Cook that the reason to get the Challenger off the ground so quickly was because there was pressure from the in the Reagan White House. I personally think the NASA people were trying to kill McAuliffe because she was very open minded, very open, informative, and very she couldn't be controlled by the government.
Yes. Yeah. So she wouldn't, as you pointed out earlier, she wouldn't lie about anything, including not seeing stars from low Earth orbit. There, you know, in other words, to keep the whole Apollo hoax from being revealed for the hoax that it was.
Yeah, but, yeah. Ultimately, it ended up just postponing the inevitable because I think it was 2002 when Spaceship One. The private, this was Richard Branson's spaceship. The pilot aboard, Michael Melville, he was in suborbit on the daylight side of the Earth, and he said, quote, "I got up there and I could see the stars and I could see the planets. I honestly thought I had reached out and touched the face of God."
Yeah, so, that's great.
So ultimately, I suspect that the Challenger disaster was either severe criminal negligence or more likely murder. Right, and so, you know, they killed these astronauts because one of them wouldn't keep quiet about the stars. She would obviously could not be controlled by NASA or the government, and so she wouldn't keep quiet about that. Now, just going back to the whole. Actually, I would like to just say real quickly off the bat, whilst reading McDonald's book, and also the testimonies of these hearings, I couldn't help but noticing there was many occasions in which they point out that the way NASA acted on the night of the teleconference, which, as I said before, there was a teleconference the night before the Challenger, in which the people at Farcol, they were trying to warn NASA not to launch in cold weather, right? McDonald and various other people, they've described the way these NASA managers reacted. They described it as being very out of character, because normally you see what they do at these pre-launch flight readiness hearings is that NASA challenge the contractors to prove that it is indeed safe to launch. If the contractor says it's safe to launch, okay, then NASA says, okay, well, prove to me that it's safe to launch. You know, let's go through everything, prove to me that it is indeed safe to launch before we take the risk. Okay, now it was reversed. They had already proven that it was not safe to launch, and now NASA was challenging them to prove that it was not safe to launch. I have many quotes here from McDonald's book along those lines. I think this is probably one of the best quotes here. This is a quote by Bob Crippen, who was one of the two astronauts on the first shuttle flight. The first shuttle flight in 1981, I believe. He was the pilot. John Young, one of the Apollo astronauts, was the command pilot on that mission. Anyways, Crippen is quoted as saying, this was during one of the hearings. He spoke up and he said, "Mr. Chairman, if I may make an observation, since the earliest days of the manned spaceflight program I've been associated with, and Mr. Neil Armstrong has been associated with, Neil Armstrong was, by the way, the vice chairman of the Presidential Commission. Okay, now quoting Crippen, if I may make an observation, since the earliest days of the manned spaceflight program that I've been associated with and that Mr. Neil Armstrong has been associated with, our basic philosophy has been, prove to me that we're ready to fly. Somehow, it seems, in this particular instance, we have switched around to prove to me that we are not able to fly. I think that was a serious mistake on NASA's part if that was the case," end quote.
That certainly brings truth into the hearing.
Yes. See, there was many people in the audience, like just listening to what these people testifying. And during the one of the closed hearings, I believe it was during the February 14 closed hearing, when Bob Crippen spoke up in the audience. How he felt, if I may make my own observation, this seems to have been our rationale seems to have been switched around. And he's not the only one who was surprised by all this thing. McDonald, he mentions about five different people. Here we go. I've got a few more quotes from the book. He says, Lindstrom, who was the Marshall Shuttle project manager, he personally knew of all the NASA participants in the teleconference very well, and he just couldn't believe that what I was telling him. This is a quote from page 135 of the book. Then later on page 144, Boyd Rinton, the Farcol chief project engineer, also told me that he was very surprised by the way Marshall people reacted to the way they did to the no launch recommendation. It was even more surprised that George Hardy reacted the way he did, as it was totally out of character for him. Hardy was normally a very thoughtful, considerate, and rather quiet individual. For him to say he was appalled at Morton Farkle's recommendation took everyone by surprise. And it goes on, there's just many, many more quotes along these lines from individuals that McDonald had spoken to or knew very well. And so it just helps solidify, in my opinion, it just helps solidify my conviction. Or I can't really say my conviction, because it was Ralph Renée the first to theorize that they were trying to silence McAuliffe. But I think it just solidifies the conviction that that NASA were trying to kill these people.
Yes, because we've got a 180-degree turn by the management, and it must be the case that they were ordered or commanded or threatened or somehow induced to behave in the contrary way they had been.
Yes. Now, just continuing on with my review of the thing, well, of the source material, anyways. I've lost my place here. I'm just trying to find my notes.
This is the most detailed movie review I've encountered, Jera. This is a lot of you've done an awful lot of homework, and it is, I think, well worthwhile to be this thorough with the movie as the provocation to dig deeply into this whole Challenger disaster.
Yes, that's correct. And as a matter of fact, one of my projects that I'm working on at the moment is I mentioned that I had interviewed Roger Beaujolais back in 2010. I'm currently producing a documentary that uses that interview that he gave me, because Beaujolais, he died in 2012 because of colon cancer. Right, he died. Obviously, you know, I was working on the film. I got sidetracked by a lot of the number of things, and that was a real regret on my part. And I decided, because this was, I essentially now have the last recording of everything that he said about Challenger. I decided to title my documentary "The Last Say on Challenger," and I released a teaser trailer for that. You can find that on my YouTube channel.
This Roger Beaujolais, you gave me a link to what he wrote regarding the ethics of engineering, and he came across as an extremely honest, upright person, and he did everything he could to halt the launch and get it right. And he says, for example, quote, "I thought it was unconscionable that Thiokol and NASA management wouldn't tell the whole truth so that the program could go forward with proper corrective measures," unquote. And Jera, you've made that point about the Apollo moon landing hoax and how it obstructs real progress on intergalactic or solar space travel for man.
Yes, the whole Apollo project has really impinged our knowledge about the moon and about solar activity on the sun, obviously. And it's until we can get the whole Apollo thing out in the open, right, NASA is going to continue lying to us, feeding us this nonsense. And it's, as a result, it's going to affect the education of the next generations. Now, I should also point out as well that Beaujolais, he didn't share the opinion that the astronauts were murdered or that the moon landings was faked. But he did believe that the disaster was not an accident, because as he told me, I actually used this clip in the teaser trailer. He said NASA tried their best to make this seem like it was an accident, and that's bullshit, because when you've got people who are your technical experts jumping up and down and raising hell trying to stop the launch and being ignored, you can't, when something goes wrong, turn around and say that it was an accident or it was a bad judgment call or this or that.
Yes, right. Excellent. And he was right in the middle of it. One of the good guys. And I wondered, this is a question related to the suit. He filed a couple of lawsuits against Thiokol and NASA, and with the idea that, hey, there's been zero accountability to date. Do you know whatever happened to his lawsuits?
Yeah, I don't remember how the lawsuit ended, but I know that that he was trying to sue NASA and Thiokol for $2 billion.
Yeah. He had, actually, I have the numbers. Of course, in a way, it doesn't matter what you put in, except that it should be a serious financial penalty. What Beaujolais said, in at least at that date, in the articles that he wrote, he said it was $1 billion lawsuit against Diakol and $10 million against NASA.
Mm. Yeah, that's sound about right. I recall reading in McDonald's book, he actually has a whole chapter about that called, what's the name of the chapter? Hang on a second. I've got the book right here. It's looking at the, trying to get to the contents of it. Here we go, chapter 32, Beaujolais' $2 billion lawsuit. They got the $2 billion figure because the shuttle, the Challenger shuttle, cost $2 billion to build. Now, ironically, that was actually their cheapest shuttle to build because it was actually built from spare parts.
Hmm.
Yeah. And it was also their lightest shuttle as well because they had a lot of the weight had been stripped down. And so yeah, it was their cheapest vehicle to build. Anyways, just getting back to the movie review right now. Now this, what happened in, I mentioned earlier how that, what was I talking about? I mentioned how that they, it was implied that, McDonald became impossible to reach after the February 10 closed hearing. And then McDonald's later seen watching the February 11 testimony at home. Well, as I said before, they still were able to reach him. And he was called over for two hearings, a closed hearing on February 14 and another, and a public hearing on February 25. And this was the hearing in which he talked up about how they were all pressured to change their minds. And one thing I should point out as well is that because he was at the Kennedy Space Center with Malloy and talking, and still it was in touch with Hardy, he was calling in from Marshall Center. While Firecall was offline, he actually tried to persuade them to at least wait. Just at least wait to launch in the afternoon, because in the afternoon it was expected to be only 50 degrees Fahrenheit. The coldest launch prior to Challenger was 53 degrees Fahrenheit, and so the afternoon temperatures on the day of the launch was to be 50 degrees, which was a bit closer to the at the time their lowest temperature launch. And Malloy's response to that was, "We've considered that and rejected it."
Why?
Something about, oh, well, it's going to be too cloudy in the thing, and then another person came on the line saying, oh, well, it's going to be days before we can guarantee it's going to be that, which was absolutely not true because the forecasting was suspecting it to be about 50 degrees in the afternoon. You know, and plus another reason he suggests there would be a good time to launch is because the original schedule, it was originally going to be an afternoon schedule for the Challenger launch, but of course they delayed it and it was delayed till the morning. What happened on it was supposed to launch on January 27, and for whatever reason they couldn't get the door handle off the hatch, and so they postponed it to the next day. You think NASA, that with all their technology in the world, they have trouble getting a simple door handle off the hatch. I'm astounded by that. Anyways, after the engineers had their say, right, the Firecall managers, they all testified, and they tried to discredit what was said. They denied that they were pressured by NASA. Mason tried to actually use McDonald as a fall guy, claiming that it was he who pressured him to change his mind. Now, after the public hearing, right, all the engineers who were working on NASA's investigation, they were all kicked off the investigation and sent back to Utah, right? And McDonald found out the next day, while he got home in time. Didn't get home in time to see the actual testimonies of the NASA guys. The NASA people were scheduled to make their testimonies the day after and the day after that, on February 26 and February 27. McDonald, he didn't get home in time to actually see this testimony live, but a friend videotaped it for him. And this was the testimony that was watching with his family. He was watching that. He was actually absolutely shocked by what he saw, because Malloy and Hardy, they were both trying to discredit his statements, making some outright lies, citing invalid data, trying to claim that they had data that the things could launch at 30 degrees. And let me tell you, those two people had a real hard time convincing their the commissioners. Now, I've got a direct quote from McDonald here, right? Finishing my review of the videotapes of the February 26 and February 27 hearings of the Presidential Commission, I was even more disturbed that I had not been allowed to attend these sessions. because of the heavy workload of the commission, and it would take another month before I would receive a formal, an official transcript of the hearings, let alone the opportunity to respond to the testimony. Even worse than that, I later found out that Morton Firecoal's legal department in Chicago prevented my responses, which were quite damaging to both NASA and Morton Firecoal management, from ever reaching the commission members. That's a direct quote on page 284 of his book.
You know, this problem, of course, extends across the United States and beyond, in that there's just such rot at the top. People are servile and craven, and they don't want to lose their livelihood or their power, be it small or great. And it's so craven when you see the Thiokol management, the corporate, they just see the dollars, millions and billions dancing in their head, and they won't go to bat on principle for their own engineers and tell the truth about what really happened.
Yeah.
It might have served them better, Jarrah, to actually, from a financial point of view, much less honesty, to tell the truth, because it's very clear that NASA needed reform and to get this right and to make a future in terms of space exploration, low orbit, and beyond.
Yeah, that's correct. And of course, not one manager from either Firecoal or NASA ever got a slap on the wrist. I've got a quote here as well from McDonald, right? You see, the movie ends with this statement. There's a picture of McDonald that appears just before the credits, and there's a little text underneath that says, McDonald went on to work with NASA of the successful redesign of the shuttle's rocket booster O-rings. Now, my comments along those lines is, that is true, but it leaves out something important. Although this is probably implied by the scenes of McDonald being unable to be reached. After his testimony, McDonald, along with all the various other Firecoal engineers who told the truth, they were demoted as punishment for telling the truth. And in the preface of his book, McDonald writes that the only reason Firecoal gave him the assignment of redesigning the booster seals was because, quote, several members of Congress threatened to ban Morton Firecoal from receiving any NASA contracts if the company didn't reinstate me to a position equivalent to the one that I had before my testimony before the Presidential Commission. Otherwise, my company would never have given me this critical assignment.
Well, hip, hip, hooray for a handful of congressmen who did that. Now, did McDonald really feel like he had important input or authority on the project to redesign these joint seals?
Well, I believe he did a good job of it, because one of the things that he did, right, you see, the way the joints work together is during the early flights up until Challenger, they would simply have a tang and clever slotted together, bolted together, and there'd be two O-rings in between these gaps to prevent the hot gases from leaking out. After Challenger, they redesigned it so there would be like a cover over the inner portion of the clevis, right? And there would also be a third O-ring in between that. So now there would be three O-rings, and they would also be enlarged as well, which helped.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I have get your reaction to this quote, because I'm looking at my notes from Roger Bourgelet, who was terminated and filed suits and was most unhappy. He said in part, quote, some people who had remained silent received promotions, and the same wouldn't face up to the original bad joint design were now directing the joint redesign effort.
Yeah, that's correct. Originally, yes, it was just, I think there's some communication problem. I'm hearing my voice in the background, but originally, yes, it was just mostly the original people who designed the original O-rings who was working on the redesign, and the Firecoal engineers who were speaking up, they had no input or very little input, which wasn't getting listened to anyways, and eventually, right, the Congress, when they found out that what they had done, that they threatened to ban Firecoal from being able to receive any NASA contracts unless they gave McDonald a position equivalent to what he had before, and assigned him the task of helping to redesign these booster seals. It's really a tragic thing is that Beaujolais and McDonald, despite their efforts to speak up, they ultimately both went very separate ways after the after the fact is that McDonald, he went on to help redesign the boosters, whereas Beaujolais, he had developed post-traumatic stress disorder, because the way he was treated after the testimonies, not just by his managers but also by some of his co-workers, they treated them like they had leprosy. In fact, the five engineers who had spoken up, they began to refer to themselves as the five lepers, right? And he eventually just developed post-traumatic stress disorder, and he had to take several months leave of absence because of his mental health. Because that's yeah. Just how bad things.
And then he had to retire as disabled. He couldn't face it to return. So, yeah. You know, they always say it's mutual agreement and the like.
Yes. And in fact, I actually had some email communications with him before he died. He mentioned to me that he actually never read any of the presidential commission report, because he felt it would just be too painful to go back, because when you develop post-traumatic stress disorder, you're advised not to go looking for things that could trigger it again. Otherwise, you can just find, even if you found yourself, you know, out of the storm and seeing the rainbows, you one simple reminder, you can go straight back to the storm. That's basically
we aren't all the same in terms of being an intellectual warrior, somebody who enjoys combat. Not everybody does, and it's harder on some personalities than others.
Yes, there's one final comment I would like to say about the movie, is that the movie, as you may already know, Feynman, he actually wrote an appendix for the presidential report, and the movie depicts Chairman Rogers as being very happy to hand President Reagan a copy of Feynman's appendix to that report. But in actuality, Rogers, he initially refused to include Feynman's paper in the report because it was too damaging to NASA. That's a direct quote, too damaging to NASA. And in turn, Feynman, he protested by refusing to sign the report. And of course, for the report to be completed, it required all signatures of everyone involved in that investigation. So they made a compromise. They agreed to include a toned down version of the report.
Yes.
That wasn't shown in the movie. And that's really the last thing I have to say about the film. One of the I've actually got Feynman's report here, and I'd like to read out the conclusions from that. This is a direct quote. He says, "For a successful technology, reality must take precedence over public relations, for nature cannot be fooled."
Yes, I love that, and it's undeniable, irrefutable. And it's very much like, it was somebody like Descartes, some philosopher of science, who said that to command nature, you must obey nature. You know, we used to have a TV commercial, I think was for butter versus oleomargarine many years ago. And the gal says, "Mustn't fool Mother Nature." Well, of course, it's impossible to. You know, all this political cross, all this public relations, all the phoniness of human beings, it doesn't cut it in terms of nature doesn't care. Nature's indifferent to us. And there's all kinds of laws that we've discovered about the behavior of nature, right? Ice is cold and water runs downhill. You know, just laws of nature that are not going to changed by any cover-up or a PR thing. So I love Feynman's he was allowed to put in as a minority report.
In fact, I actually sent you a news report which contained that thing. Did you have that clip?
Do you want to play that? Okay. Oh, that's right. We were gonna. I needed to transfer that to Pete to allow that to play, and I'll bet you we can do that. Can you send that clip, Vera, direct to Pete? I will. You're listening to the Rebels Reveal, and Jarrah White is enlightening the pastor calendar. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and if you want to call in, please do at 218-622-4400. 9829 here on the Guerrilla Media Network. And my wonderful guest, he is I gotta say this, you're a living treasure, Gerald White, for such a young man. I so appreciate what you do. And Gerald is from Sydney, Australia, grandson of the Apollo moon hoax theory. And he is explaining to us what happened with the space shuttle Challenger and its disaster, as well as the movie that dramatizes this whole disaster. So, Pete, I guess we have, you have a video ready for us to play. Maybe, Jerry, do you want to introduce what we've got to listen to here?
Yes, first of all, this video clip has Fireman's actual doing the experiment. Unfortunately, you can't see it because it's audio, but you can hear basically what he did with the O-ring. And then there's a news report from MSNBC, which talked about how there was that report that he wanted to include, but it was too damaging to NASA. So if you want to just play the clip.
Well, I took this stuff that I got out of your seal, and I put it in ice water. And I discovered that when you put some pressure on it for a while and then undo it, it maintains, it doesn't stretch back, it stays the same dimension. In other words, for a few seconds at least, and more seconds than that, there's no resilience in this particular material when it's at a temperature of 32 degrees. I believe that has some significance for our problem.
Chairman William Rogers personally brought the commission report to the White House this evening. Earlier in the day, he'd been asked about it.
It's been a long 4 months. Are you satisfied with your work?
Well, satisfaction is not the right word. I think the report is a good, thorough report.
But it developed, Rogers had barely managed to keep his commission completely united. One prominent member had threatened not to sign the report. That was Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, who startled the commission months ago when he dipped an O-ring into his glass of ice water to show that it wouldn't work when it was cold. A NASA analysis had projected that the chance of a shuttle accident was only 1 in 100,000. But Feynman ridiculed that in a harshly worded critique written for the report. But Chairman Rogers, according to other commissioners, thought Feynman's criticism could be too damaging to NASA. And Rogers said he was going to throw it out of the final report. Late last week, an angry Feynman sent a letter to Rogers, threatening not to sign the report as a matter of conscience. At that point, Rogers and his staff backed down somewhat. They agreed to include a toned-down version of Feynman's critique of NASA in an appendix to the report to be published next month.
Gerald White, would you like to comment, or what are your thoughts there?
I think the news report speaks for itself. That's the whole situation. Is that the commission, the Rogers Commission, they beat NASA up pretty bad, but ultimately they were not allowed to go all the way in brutalizing NASA to the point that it would be an ineffective agency. And so that's one of the reasons why Chairman Rogers was reluctant to include that report in the commission. So they had that back and forth, and eventually they decided to include the toned down version. And, you know, I was reading the report the other day, and I just kind of wondering, if this is the toned-down version, what was the unaltered version like? Because it's very, very critical of NASA.
Yes. It's really interesting that, of course, commissions are appointed, investigative commissions are appointed to smooth things over and cover up, but almost inevitably, they reveal some of the truth. And to put a man like Richard Feynman, who, I mean, you talk about an independent thinker, a very likable man, and he was a brilliant teacher, not just a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. And he just was an intellectual adventurer, a discoverer. It put him on that kind of commission. I don't think it could happen anymore. In fact, he might have been the last example of putting on such an independent man who will not be messed with in terms of intellectual integrity. So it's wonderful that he was there.
I have to say something about Feynman. I have to say that I hadn't read his book for a while, and one of the reasons, of course, is because of his involvement with the Manhattan Project. he was the one who actually determined how much plutonium would be needed to use in the bomb. You know, I think anyone who worked on the Manhattan Project, well, has blood on their hands. But I think Feynman, he obviously had a moral conscience because he obviously had voiced regrets about his involvement in that project. And I think his morality really spoke during his independence in that investigation. The Challenger disaster.
You know, I saw him comment about that part of his life. And remember, he was born in 1918. So he would have been, under 30. He would have been in his 20s when he participated in the Manhattan Project. And he said, of course, at the time, we've got to stop the Germans. We've got to get there before they do. That kind of rationale. Even though he says he's participating in a weapon development, so you at least are aware. Of course, you're in war mode, but of course he thought at the time on that it was justified. But then, yes, later on he, I know that after the war he said, he took it to, he had such second thoughts and maybe regret that he looked around and he said, why are all these people engaging in building things, these construction projects, for example? Because he knew that a few of these bombs over New York City were just going to be devastating to people, life and property. And he thought, really, with the way these nation states are, the way man is, it's so we're at the end, it would seem. So, yeah, he had his regrets.
Mm. That's actually, his regret is actually reenacted in the movie that I was just reviewing. There was about one or two, or maybe three moments in which he recollects on the Manhattan Project and has voiced his regrets about that. And one of his regrets was that he thought the Germans were going to be building a nuclear bomb. And of course, they didn't have nuclear technology back then, not the Germans anyways. And so, yeah, that was one of his big regrets. And so for me, I actually, I was always at a bit of a moral dilemma because one part of me feels like, how could you involve yourself in that horrible thing which resulted in the deaths of all these thousands of people? But on the other hand, I have a level of, I guess, forgiveness for him because he voiced regret about that and he helped be independent on the commission of the
The government is the only government to have used this kind of weapon against a quote enemy, unquote, and taking enormous civilian life. A lot of our military commanders, Dwight D. Eisenhower included, advised against it. And it's just a scandal of the first rank that Harry S. Truman and his ilk dropped this twice on Japan. It was completely unnecessary from a military point of view, said our top military commanders. So
it was unnecessary because the Japanese already retreated back to the homeland. And so I get really, really pissed off and aggravated when people say, "Oh, we had to do it to get the Japanese to get them to surrender." Well, they've already retreated, and then other people say, "Oh, well, we were targeting weapons factories." Targeting weapons factories with an atomic bomb. All right, that's like trying to swat a fly with a giant wrecking ball.
Yeah.
I don't even want to get started in the argument because it just really aggravates me way, way too much, you know, because as far as I'm concerned, it was terrorism on the United States part. And I just, before I lose my temper here, I would just like to make a statement for anyone listening who believes that the bombings wasn't terrorism. I challenge you to go to Japan, go to Hiroshima or Nagasaki, find anyone who was lucky enough to survive the subsequent radiation fallout, anyone who was a relative of someone who died in these horrible attacks. Okay, I challenge you to go find these people, look them in the eye, and tell them that it was not terrorism.
Yes, point taken. Yes. Let's go back to the Challenger disaster, which I gather you think was deliberate destruction of these seven lives, but One thing I had in my notes from Roger Beaujolais, who was one of the good guys as an engineer at Morton Thiokold, he says the following. Management claimed other than low temperatures, twisted O-rings prior to mating. I don't know if my handwriting's correct, but I'll go on. Yet, this was referring to a photo, which Beaujolais says was only a track of smeared grease. He says the O-ring could not twist as they contended. And he proved it via a desktop test for himself. And NASA management finally had to admit, this was one of their lies, that the photo showed a smeared grease track. So explain that for us, Jarrah.
Yeah, well, as I said before, there were two groups of people who were investigating the Challenger disaster. There was the Presidential Commission run by Chairman Rogers, and then there was the NASA investigation, which was the what did they call it again? They called it the SRM failure analysis team, which involved members from both NASA and Morton Thiokol, right? And one of the things Beaujolais talked about this in his interview that he gave me. NASA tried to shift the blame away from cold weather, right? And one of the things that they were claiming was that one of the O-rings had gotten twisted. And Beaujolais, he said, well, that's impossible. What he did was he took a piece of O-ring about arm's length, got a little whiteout pen, drew a little line of whiteout over the top of it, and so you could see the whiteout twist and turn as the O-ring twisted and turned. Basically, he twisted it this way and that and moved it all around the place. It would be all twisted in a coil, and when he let go, it just bounced straight back into the original position. And he said, so you're telling me that we could put a twisted O-ring in the seal? I'm telling you that's a physical impossibility. And NASA, they spent about, I think it was two weeks down at the plant trying to prove that you could fit a twisted O-ring into the joint, which was like multi-million dollars worth of maintenance and experiments and everything else. Wasted millions of dollars trying to prove that they could do it, and they couldn't do it. And I had to confess Beaujolais was right. And I think after he was kicked off the commission, they still included that anyway in their final report that it might have been a twisted O-ring, if I recall correctly. But I had to say another thing too is that when the NASA investigation that was headed by a fellow by the name of Bob Schwinghammer, right? He called all these people down to Washington D.C. on February 4. And they would do it. They were going. They had them all in a conference room. All these different people from NASA and Morton Thiokol in the room. Beaujolais and McDonald were both in the room. And Schwinghammer, he wanted them to go through every single possible cause of failure. All these millions of things that could have caused the failure. And McDonald, he spoke up saying, we don't need to go through 90% of those because we already have the videos of the SRB leaking hot gas. So we can narrow it down to these 10 things that have anything to do with these videos, because like we have this video footage to correlate with the flight data. And Schwinghammer was very angry at McDonald and it pointed out that only he and McDonald at the time had actually seen those videos. He and McDonald were the only two people in that entire room who had seen those videos. And he said we have to conduct we're not going to be focusing on the photographic evidence. We're going to be focusing on the data. And McDonald, he persisted saying, we don't need to focus on all this flight data because it's irrelevant. It's been contradicted by the videos. And finally, Schwinghammer, he was very, very angry. He said, I am in charge of this investigation team, not you, McDonald. If you aren't going to support the team as I direct, you should get the hell out of this room. That's exactly what McDonald did. He took his chair, went out into the hallway and spent the next 2 days conducting his own investigation. And he was able to narrow down the cause of the disaster as being a leaking O-ring due to the cold weather. Not just the cold weather, but also the coldness from the cryogenic tanks as well. Because you see, there was like some excess temperature because they're using liquid fuel. They need to use cryogenic fuel to keep the propellants in liquid form. You know, and so obviously things get really cold during these preparations, and it even worsens the problem in the cold weather. And so he concluded, yes, it was these cold conditions that caused the leak. So that was
Hey, Jarrah, let me ask you in the spirit of a summing up, going back to the movie per se, what kind of grade would you give it? Maybe we can use a scale of 0 through 10, and then cite the pluses and minuses. For example, I wondered if you enjoyed it. I think it's 90 minutes. It seems to be well produced. But what grade would you give it, or how would you grade it?
I would give it a 7. It did a good job of demonstrating how NASA was being very dishonest, but at the same time, it took so many liberties with the source material and moved things around for dramatic purposes or for timing constraints or for whatever. And as a result, a lot of key important things were actually ignored or combined. And a lot of stuff actually ignored, like Richard Cook and Beaujolais aren't even mentioned in the video. And in fact, actually, the actor playing McDonald actually looks a lot more like Beaujolais. And this is just my own opinion, but I think it's accurate. I think they might have actually originally cast him as Beaujolais, but they probably changed it to McDonald at the last minute. I don't know if that's just my own theory. But yeah, so they didn't cover Beaujolais. They didn't cover the memos that he and Cook had sent to their superiors. And of course, because the O-ring stunt was the O-ring thing, which Feynman took the O-ring out of his glass of ice water, because that was a very dramatic, most remembered thing, they decided to move it to the very end, and so they could accommodate things that happened much later in the investigation, like his going down to the Marshall Center or this or that. And so they tried their best they could to incorporate so many key events, but of course, largely because it's told mostly from Feynman's point of view, a lot of the important things were ignored. You know, from say Beaujolais' point of view, there was a little of McDonald's point of view there, but there was most of it was just got shuffled to the side. And I feel they could have been a lot better had they I don't know, maybe it might have been worked better had they made it a miniseries. You know, one episode focusing on all the different chronological events that happened with the thing. See, I can't speak for the filmmakers myself, but when I'm doing a documentary or anything really based on a true event, I like things to be chronologically accurate, chronologically, like historically correct. Like, okay, this happened first, that happened first, not move something here, okay, because it looks better here, or we want to save this for the end, but it happened earlier. No, it's better, so we move it here. And so overall, I think it did a good job of demonstrating how dishonest NASA was being, but at the same time, it falls short of being truly great, truly what it could have been.
The acting, from what I saw, is excellent. But really, you're criticizing the script, and I really appreciate your thought that if it were a documentary, for sure you'd want it chronologically correct. But they, in a way, they fictionalized what could have been treated more literally. Yes. And I wonder, has NASA made any public reaction? Probably not. But what is there any feedback from that quarter?
Well, not that I know of, but I do know that Richard Cook, he actually wrote a review to it. He didn't like the film much because one of the things that, as I mentioned before, his side of the thing was actually ignored. And I think one of the reasons he found it was important is because when he leaked his memo to the press, it was published in the front page of the New York Times. And the commissioner, particularly Rogers, he was very angry that he had to read about this memo in the press before they actually received anything from these guys. And so he chastised him during the testimony, and of course that wasn't included in the film. And so that was one of the objections that Cook had made about the movie. I don't know what McDonald had to say about it, and of course Beaujolais is no longer with us, so he could not be reached for comments along these lines. You mentioned earlier the acting as well in the film. And I will say one thing about the guy playing Fireman. I don't know what it is, but for some reason, I think he reminded me a bit more of Harvey Dent from The Dark Knight than he did of Fireman.
You know, they made up William Hurt to resemble Fireman fairly well, like his hair a little on the wild side. And yeah. But what is missing, and I watched an hour or two of Fireman in various video interviews, and biography, it must have been 2 hours. And Feynman has always got a smile on his face and a laugh in his heart. You know, he was telling about his life with his father and really reminiscing quite a bit and had very powerful observations to make about a lot of things. But he was basically a very happy guy. And he He died within 2 years of his struggles against cancer following the commission.
Yeah, he had developed cancer from the nuclear bomb testing during the Manhattan Project, as I recall. But he died 2 years after the commission, and ultimately his legacy seems to be that his writings, particularly that report that they almost didn't include in the final commission report.
Well, from an academic's point of view, he's achieved immortality. Assuming all of his work in quantum mechanics holds up. This was, for an academic like him, a sideline appointment. It's kind of interesting to find out what the story was to get him appointed, but it certainly lent a star quality to it.
That's actually mentioned as how he was appointed it's mentioned in the movie. The reason why he was appointed is because the administrator of NASA, who was actually filling in for the main administrator, actually resigned and he was just filling in as a substitute. The administrator at the time, a fellow by the name of Graham, he actually suggested to have Feynman on the commission because Feynman was one of his teachers during his college years. But I actually have to say one thing. This is probably a good way to close off. Is that just before the February 11 hearing, the acting NASA administrator William Graham, he actually told this to the commission, and this is a direct quote: "Should any error, partial or incomplete, or possibly misleading statement be found, an amendment to the testimony should be filed in order to clarify the concern. We realize that it is possible for NASA to occasionally misspeak or delete something inadvertent."
Hmm.
That I found was very revealing. It's like he was apologizing in advance for the lies that NASA was going to tell during the commission and testimony hearings.
And hey, if the first murder is the toughest, NASA had been involved, although I doubt they hired the hitman directly or the like. But it's a military CIA intelligence complex front. I mean, this happy face that it's a civilian agency and all that is a lie. So it's when he was warned, Feynman or others, to watch your backside. I mean, that's a threat, and it's a threat that's credible because of the history of NASA.
Yeah. And plus, I remember as well, getting back to what I said earlier, McDonald, he was so scared that he was going to have a plane crash on his way over to the testimony that he actually made notes, copies of all his notes, and gave them to a colleague of his, asked him to submit it to the commission if anything happened to him. That really lit me up. I have to tell you, when I was reading McDonald's book for the first time, I had a little notepad, sticky notes and a pen. I was constantly making notes. Previous books that I read, I filled up, maybe one or two notes in the book. This one is practically, I'm looking at the book now, it's completely filled with sticky notes, completely pinpointing all the different indications that something was up, that he felt he was in danger or that he was going to be attacked or discredited by NASA, or that they were ignoring the warnings and the red flags and everything else. It's just astounding.
It is. And before we close out, Jarrah White, I haven't been watching space news lately, but I guess in the popular press, they pointed out about something about Chang'e 3 going dark and then it came back to life. So what's the latest going on in space news?
Well, the latest that they've said is that they've regained contact with the thing. It's still be able to transmit, but to the best of my knowledge, it's still having the mechanical problems and it being unable to move. This is not the first time it happened, you see, because it was deployed on December 14 of last year. But between December 16 and 20, it was unable to move because it had to shut down its subsystems because they had overheated from absorbing direct solar radiation, which heated the craft to something like 100 degrees Celsius. And they had to shut down the subsystems, and so it didn't move. And just before it was shut down for the night, you see, the lunar nights, they last something like 2 weeks. Because the moon is tidally locked with the Earth, we only see one side of it. So the dark side of the dark portion that you see during the phases is the nighttime side. Anyways, when it was supposed to shut down, and when it shut down, it closes its solar panels to protect it from the cold. And because so much dust got into the system, it couldn't close them. And as such, the things froze during the night. And now when they tried to start it up again, they couldn't start it up again. And finally, they say, okay, we've regained contact, but it's not moving. They're receiving data from it, but it's not moving. So, and when many of my friends I've wrote in to point this out is that, wow, this never happened on the Apollo projects.
Yeah, glitch-free Apollo 11, the first trip to land a man on the moon. Isn't that amazing?
And let's not forget the later missions, the J-type missions, which lasted for 3 days on the lunar surface alone. And they had the rovers, they had the lunar rovers, which they used to drive around supposedly. And the Chang'e 3 overheats in 2 days. On the third day, they're still driving around and everything else. What? How's that happen? Doesn't make a sense.
And how did they, Algera, how did they pack that rover into the lunar module? I don't know where the humans went.
The claim is that the wheels fold up and then it folds into the side of the descent stage. They didn't carry it into the actual cabin. That's what they say. But still, yeah. The fact that they never suffered this overheating problem or too much dust getting into the system, destroying it and everything else, it's just really astounding how the inconsistencies between the American rover and the Chang'e 3 rover. It's just incredible.
Yeah, even a product reminds me of the Dreamliners, the Boeing 787 model that had all the heating overheating problems with the lithium battery. So even some relatively low tech and well-experienced commercial production with fairly modest technological advance can have a lot of problems.
Mm. Yes, it can. It can. And it's funny you should actually mention that the airplane thing. There's just one thing that came to mind during the one of the testimonies of Molloy. This was after the shit at the fan regarding the cold temperature warnings. One of the commissioners says, it was Katina, he says, suppose we were running an airline company and there was a huge back and forth between you and Boeing about the possibility of a wing falling off. Would you not tell the pilots about this concern?
What's Molloy's answer?
he had really no comment for that because he could tell that he was just really painted into a corner and that he was fighting a losing battle.
Hey, we've had a wonderful time learning more space news and talk about the Challenger disaster back in 1986. And I so much appreciate Jared White's movie review of the movie The Challenger Disaster, released November 16. And it's amazing. I keep on coming back to this rise-to-the-top problem here in America. It's an awful situation. You're listening to The Reynolds Reveal, and I, your host, work and insightful, elucidating truthing. Thank you, Jarrah.
Pleasure to be here.